Dr. Charles Vanderhorst is one of those doctors whose approach to medicine goes beyond good bedside manner. He prioritizes actually getting to know his patients. Early in his career, he found himself on the front lines of the AIDS epidemic and eventually helped to open an AIDS clinic at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Activism has been another cornerstone of Charlie's career. He was arrested at the state capitol for protesting Republican policies and has been very vocal in his opposition to the death penalty. Charlie Vanderhorst joins me now. He's a professor emeritus in medicine and infectious diseases at UNC School of Medicine. Charlie, welcome to State. It's good to have you.
Frank, it's great to be here. Thanks for asking me to participate.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning of your career and your life. You actually, your parents came from Europe, and your mother had to escape the Nazis during World War II. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my mother was at the time in the in Poland when the war broke out, and initially Poland was split in two, with the Russians taking the eastern half, and then the Nazis invaded in 1941, and she was behind Nazi lines then, and in quick succession, her father and 12-year-old sister were shot, and her mother was deported to Belzec, the concentration camp. And then she changed her name to pretend it was Ukrainian and escaped on a workers' train to the belly of the beast in Germany, and that's where she survived.
And ultimately met your father.
That's correct. So they were teaching each other languages, working in Germany, and then she had to go in hiding because they were repatriating everyone who'd been in the Soviet Union, and she obviously didn't want to go back. Mm. And although they were not even on a first-name basis, my father then proposed to her and said, well, why don't you marry me? And her statement was that, well, you know, here I was and orphan, I had no money, no prospects, and he was relatively good looking, and love was not part of the issue. I said, we'll try it out. So she said yes.
Well, it seemed to work out very well. Eventually, they came to the United States. Tell us how that came to be.
So my grandfather and grandmother were both engineers and had patented a mechanism and that would help both piston rings last longer and gun barrels. And so they had set up a factory in the U.S., and my father came to run that.
And you were raised in upstate New York?
That's correct.
And what was that like for you? What was life like around the house when you were a boy?
Well, it was a very serious household. The focus was on our education. We each had to learn a language on the side, piano lessons, etc. So play was not a high issue on that. And so, like, my interest in sports was totally on my own. My parents could care less about that stuff. So education was the focus of our household.
So much so that you go to Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, it's one of the Eatons of the United States. This means you are on your way to college, young man.
Correct. I got a scholarship there, and my parents dropped me off in September and picked me up in May. But I got a fabulous education there.
Was it your idea too? I mean, were you pretty well focused and headed to college, or were you at this point thinking having other thoughts?
No, I was totally focused on college. I mean, I was worried a little bit that I would be drafted and sent to Vietnam, and I didn't feel I was a conscientious objector, so I had sort of decided in my own mind that if my draft number was low, that I would actually go to Canada because I didn't believe in the war.
Well, and as a matter of fact, you go from Andover to Duke University. Now, we know Duke now as one of these top-tier institutions. 1970... I don't know that it had quite that reputation, did it?
It did not, no. And what happened is that I wrote a fiery essay. So I've been pretty much an activist all my life. And I wrote a fiery college essay and then ended up getting rejected from every place except Duke. The college advisor called up one of the Ivy Leagues and said, why didn't you take Charles Vanderhorst? And the college guy said, do you realize we've just had the police removing protesters from Lowell Library and the hall at Harvard? He said, do you think we want another person like that in our undergraduate body. So
we will get to know the man they missed and the guy they lost, Charlie Vanderhorst, a professor emeritus in medicine and infectious disease at the UNC School of Medicine. Our conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dr. Charlie Vanderhorst is that kind of doctor who's invested in building relationships with his patients, but he didn't always want to be in medicine. During his undergrad years at Duke University, he studied chemistry and history. Throughout his career as an infectious disease doctor, he has worked on the front lines of the AIDS epidemic and today helping to wipe out hepatitis C in Wake County. Well, tell us about the decision to become, you went to Duke, but at that moment you weren't thinking of becoming a doctor, or were you?
No, and in fact, until age 14, I wanted to become a chef at Pacioli's Italian Restaurant in Olean, New York. And then I went to Duke, and I decided I wanted to be a math teacher, and I took calculus, and I realized that would be a horrible mistake. And so I started, and I loved history, so I said, well, maybe I'll become a history teacher. And then I spent a couple summers working in a hospital in Boston, the Robert Breck Brigham Hospital, and I read every autobiography I could by physicians to try to get a sense of what the life of a physician would be like. And I decided I wanted to do that.
Well, that's interesting to me. I mean, when you say I was in a hospital, what kind of work were you doing?
So I was an orderly in the operating room, and that was fun and interesting from sort of a science, intellectual science way. But the pivotal moment for me was when this was a rheumatologic hospital. So there was a lot of orthopedic surgery going on, but they also had lupus patients. And, and lupus is a disease that can cause lupus cerebritis, so an inflammation of the brain, and can lead to psychoses, et cetera. And so there was a young woman with terrible lupus and terrible lupus cerebritis, and who was psychotically depressed and suicidal. So they asked me to spend a night watching her to make sure she didn't harm herself. And so I sat in the room, and it literally was a dark and stormy night with these huge, 12-foot sash windows. The window was open. The curtains were blowing, and I was alone with this young woman, and I was sort of helping her. You know, I was calming her, and I didn't know we were going to make it through the night, and I did, and I realized, gee, you know, I like this, and I think I'm good at it, and so that was the pivotal moment for me.
I think that answers my next question, because as you were telling the story, Charlie, that is what drives most people away from medicine, I mean, or that kind of a career. That is to say, being in such a precarious position that seems so daunting to be with someone who's out of control like that, and your job is to make sure that they don't do the worst to themselves. But apparently it was the sense of success that you had. You got through the night.
Well, I've always liked challenges.
Yeah.
And I like transforming myself and trying to figure out how to do things. So it was, you know, it was ridiculous to have somebody in college sit with this woman who had a severe clinical illness, and I had zero training. I was put in that room, make sure she doesn't jump out the window, and that was it. That was my training.
All right, so now you're making it up as you go along. What did you do?
I just started talking calmly to her. And, you know, when she started confabulating about her psychoses, I would talk her down from that and calm her down. She actually tried to hurt me. She grabbed my hand and dug her nail in, and I still actually have the scar from where that happened. And, you know, you just figure it out. If you listen to your patients pay attention to them, then you can learn a lot from your patients.
And I wonder to what extent, even in a psychotic state, and we can only speculate, that her sense of you listening was some measure or some part of her perhaps calming down, but we can only speculate. So you do go to medical school. You applied to many and ended up at Harvard. What was that time like for you?
Well, at Harvard, I found instantly a group of like-minded people. We were progressive. We loved medicine. We loved patient care. We loved the science of medicine. And I had some fabulous lecturers. So intellectually, that was great. Many of those lecturers went on to get Nobel Prizes, and that's the quality of their research. So I had a great time there.
Did you, at that moment, did you make a decision, or did you realize you had a decision to make between research and clinical practice?
No, not really. I mean, I was interested in it. I didn't do any research in medical school. I loved clinical medicine. I had some fabulous rotations with wonderful mentors, adolescent medicine, working in the community. I spent a month working in the Boston City Hospital because I wanted an experience in a public hospital, and the Harvard hospitals were all private. And, you know, I had was assigned a patient with alcoholic cirrhosis, and I just bonded with this guy, and, you know, it was just a wonderful experience. So it certainly convinced me that I wanted to do clinical medicine.
And for your residency, you chose a public hospital, right?
Well, it was a combination public-private. It was Montefiore Medical Center, which is private, but it's literally physically connected to one of the New York City hospitals, North Central Bronx Hospital.
So what was that experience like?
Well, it was just phenomenal. You worked harder than you could possibly imagine. So for all 3 years, I was on call every third night. So there was never, you know, like you weren't on call. You were always on call, always sleep deprived. And but the patients just were such a reflection of the United States. So we had new immigrants from Vietnam, Hmong refugees who would present with bizarre diseases that I had never seen, disseminated tuberculosis. We had intravenous drug users with endocarditis. We had young African-American kids, adolescents dying of asthma in front of me from their wretched living conditions. We had elderly Jewish and Italian immigrants coming in with congestive heart failure. So this whole panoply of interesting people with bad disease.
Was this the genesis of your social political activism? We'll talk more about that later as it blossoms, or had that always been part of your life?
Activism was always part of my life. You know, my parents, when they arrived in the United States, it was the era in 52, just after I was born. That was the McCarthy era. That was Jim Crow. And they were horrified. So believe it or not, my parents, they step off the boat. They join immediately the ACLU, the NAACP. When I was in middle school, my father took me to march in for the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. So that was always there.
Did he talk about that? I mean, any of the paradox? Here's your mother escaping the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust and steps into the United States where it was not that severe. But as you say, McCarthyism, Jim Crow, many of the things that are perhaps less viral, less virulent, but still pretty ugly. Had they expected that, and did it surprise them?
So I think so. I mean, they never really talked a lot about it with us. I guess the best example is that my father was head of the local field service, the AFS thing where students, high school students, go overseas. Mm-hmm. And it was during the Vietnam era, and one young Olean High School student refused to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance, and she had just been awarded this scholarship to go overseas, and the board wanted to take it away from her. And my father said, look, when I came to the United States, I didn't pledge to uphold the flag. I pledged to uphold the Constitution, and she has a First Amendment right to speak her piece. And so that's the kind of stuff I learned from my parents.
Meanwhile, we're talking about your residency, too, in the Bronx, and it was there where you had a patient who had AIDS, but we didn't know much about AIDS at the time, right?
Right. So the first reports about AIDS were June of 1981. Mm-hmm. I began my residency in 79, and my first year as an intern, I had a patient, which in retrospect, we now know would have been AIDS, who was admitted.
And so what did you think at the time? Again, there wasn't this diagnosis, and yet you're seeing these rather unusual diseases that he's manifesting, right?
So, right. This was a It was a terrible, terrible case because this poor young man came in and he was already intubated and on a ventilator when I picked him up in the emergency room. So I couldn't speak with him. He was unconscious. We didn't know who his family he had been found. We didn't know who his family members were, friends or anything. So this was a very sad young man. He had clearly lost an enormous amount of weight. It looked like he'd come from a concentration camp. And then he had this bizarre constellation of diseases. So a rare pneumonia. I had to call the U.S. Centers for Disease Control to get the medicine to treat it because that's where the medicine came from. And then, of course, he, despite all my efforts, he died. So it was a very tragic and sad.
And at this point in your career, you're interested in two specialties, right? Infectious disease and oncology. Am I right?
You're correct. And I like them because little disparaging comment. I thought the other internal medicine subspecialties were like plumbing, and it didn't required to think about the whole patient. And I wasn't just interested in hearts or lungs. I liked internal medicine. So I wanted to deal with the whole patient. And basically that then you're dealing with either oncology or infectious diseases. But I thought, gee, I don't have the emotional stamina to take care of all those my patients dying from cancer. So I need to go into infectious diseases and treat little old ladies with urinary tract infections. And of course, lo and behold, AIDS epidemic starts.
But again, what you said was interesting. I mean, the idea that you didn't think you had the psychological wherewithal to endure the loss of these patients, and so you go into this other field, and then you find yourself in the heart of the AIDS crisis. Now, you can walk away from that, too, and specialize in little old ladies with UTIs, if you chose, but you didn't. So talk about why you found yourself involved and embroiled, really, in the AIDS crisis at the moment.
Well, it's that's an interesting question. So you just got to step up to the plate. If you see a problem, you can't walk away from it. That would have felt worse. I can't overstate how difficult it was for me. And we didn't know how to treat it. We didn't even have good drugs to treat depression in those days. We didn't know how to diagnose the various infections they got. We didn't know you had to put them on antibiotics for the rest of their life to suppress it. We had no drugs to treat the virus itself. We didn't even know it was a virus in the beginning. So, but you got to step up to the plate.
All right. So let's take it from there. You got it. You're not the kind of a guy who's just going to walk away from a challenge. But again, there's this, we're going to lose these patients. So one way you can approach it is to say, well, this is an enormous intellectual challenge. Let me just apply myself to the medicine here. And of course, we're going to lose people along the way. But it seems that that was not your approach. You developed close bonds as well as you were in the fight, the intellectual fight, to figure out what's wrong and how to fix it. You also developed bonds with these people who you knew you were going to lose.
Yeah, and I still remember all those patients. One of them, the AIDS house here in Durham is named over Nat Blevins, and he was a local activist, and he ended up, he was one of the first members on the first Presidential AIDS Commission in Washington, and I had this pivotal interaction with him at one point where I wanted him to start this new medicine, AZT, although it hadn't been approved yet for his level of disease. And so he asked me my advice, and I got all upset. And I said, but, Nat, I think I need to find you another doctor because, you're my friend and I love you. And what if I give you the wrong advice? And he was the calm one. He said, no. That's why I want you to be my doctor. I want you to wrestle with me on this problem.
And you did. Was this when, by then, had you had the job at Duke University?
So, I can't remember when. I first met Nat before I went to Duke and then continued to follow him at Duke. And then when I went back, was asked to come back to UNC, and he followed me there as well.
Because you were doing clinical research at Duke, right?
No, I was doing lab research.
Oh, lab research.
I was doing lab research.
And that you didn't like.
No, I quickly realized that was a big mistake, and I keep changing my career over the life.
Yeah, because developing a relationship with a lab mouse, I mean, that's weeks. You know,
right.
That seems really silly.
this was less than a mouse. It was cell cultures.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So, but and then you found your way to UNC, ultimately.
Right. Yeah, I was asked to come back and run the AIDS clinical trials unit there. That was an NIH-funded group.
But that sounds like some bench research as well, but it was clinical research. You were dealing with people.
That was clinical research, okay. And that's where I did the bulk of my research in my career.
And at that point, where was the research now? How much we knew a lot more by that time.
So this was in 1988. Mm. We knew AZT had been approved. We had the blood test on how to test it, but not much more than that. When I was doing that, we were doing all those clinical trials to show, to develop and get approval for these various medications to treat HIV and the infections that patients with advanced AIDS get.
Were you at that time, because again, I think one of the focuses here, certainly in your career, is this idea that to do this right, you should develop a personal relationship, which to some degree is what they might tell you not to do in your career. I mean, are you working AMA here?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a complicated thing. So I'll tell you a thing about how. So I would develop these relationships with patients, and many, of course, are short-lived because if you have advanced AIDS in those days, you wouldn't survive much longer than 6 months on average. And I would go to the autopsy of my patients after they died. And so I could try to figure out what had caused their death. And then from there, I would go to their funerals and be asked to give a eulogy. Mm-hmm. And I would weep as I was developing that, giving those eulogies.
And this is what we mean. I mean, if I say personal relationship, I mean getting to know them in a way that somebody running a clinical trial doesn't have to.
But it enriched my life to have these relationships with these patients. I mean, it's, you know, it was painful. Mm. I mean, I'm getting teary-eyed just talking about it. But it just enriched my life, and it still does with these patients.
How so? And not so. Does it in any way affect the research that you do or the way you interpret the research? Does it make it better, stronger, weaker, more suspect?
Well, I listen to the patients, and they if you listen to them, then you do the research that's important to them, and don't do research that you think is unethical.
Was there an example of that? Something that changed in the way you did things as a result of listening?
Well, it's interesting. I'll bring you up to date. So I'm treating people with hepatitis C at Open Door Clinic in Raleigh now, where I volunteer. And the standard protocol to treat hepatitis C has frequent visits to the doctor, an enormous amount of blood is drawn, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized there's no way we can do that. A lot of my patients, some of them are homeless, they're in substance abuse centers, they have terrible mental illness and are often psychotic. I can't have them come back and forth to the clinic, you know, six times. So what I do is I change the protocol. That's actually being studied in a current NIH trial. But that trial is, you don't need to do a study to do that. You need to listen to your patients. And I see them once, I hand them the drug, and I text them weekly. They have my cell phone. I'm not supposed to do that either. but I text them weekly, and then they come out on the other end, and they're cured. And I don't draw blood in between, and it's working. You know, we have 18 people are cured of hepatitis C already, and I have these wonderful, happy patients by not doing what I think is research that shouldn't be done.
And the reason you came to that thinking is by listening to them and seeing what their patterns were. So
right.
That didn't come out of your head.
Yeah.
Came out of your experience and listening to people. Charlie Vanderhorst is a professor emeritus of medicine and infectious diseases at UNC School of Medicine. We're going to talk more about his work with Hep C in Wake County, and perhaps they'll pick it up all over the globe. We'll talk more about that on the State of Things in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Charlie Vanderhorst today. Spent his career working with AIDS patients in North Carolina and Africa. And even though he's retired, he does spend a lot of time thinking about medicine. He volunteers now at Urban Ministries' Open Door Clinic in Raleigh. Charlie Vanderhorst is a professor emeritus in medicine and infectious diseases at UNC School of Medicine. I'll talk to you about the personal toll that this may have taken on you, because before we get to more of this work that you're doing in Raleigh, I want to talk about this time in your life, a difficult time around 2014 when you began to suffer depression.
Yeah, I'd had depression off and on for a good chunk of my life, but in 2014, it got really, really bad. I started, the world just seemed gray. You know, William Styron's described his own depression in a wonderful short volume about it. And you feel like you're in a cloud. And, you know, at nighttime, I'd lie there in bed and it'd just be dark, but it felt like the whole was black. Cloud would descend on me. I started crying at the least thing. I started getting angry. I would have nightmares every night towards the end of December that my boss was stabbing me to death and another colleague was watching, and it was a terrible time.
Something that you were trying to conceal from your wife and friends initially.
Well, that's very common. You know, people hide depression. It's stigmatized. You know, we don't talk about it. We're ashamed of it. And so you put on this cheery face. So many people with depression do that.
You did decide to get help. Talk about that.
I eventually decided to get help when I started scaring myself with my suicidal ideation, and found a wonderful therapist here in Durham through Fenn's, and he finally convinced me I was reluctant to start a medication, and suggested that I apply for a family medical leave.
You did. Was that difficult for you to walk away like that?
Oh, it's a huge thing.
Yeah.
You know, my work defined my life for 30 years, which is, of course, when you think about it, is a totally crazy thing. That's not what life is. It's only part of life. But for me, it was my life. So the good thing that came out of the depression, that it allowed me to make that decision.
But you did, and initially not easy. To what extent was that work life, did it contribute to this depression?
Well, I was feeling trapped in my job. I didn't know, I couldn't imagine life outside of it. I was getting, in retrospect, I had some post-traumatic stress from my early days of an AIDS doc and losing all those patients. Like I said, I still remember them all those early deaths. And so I think that was, and it's hard to do patient care of AIDS patients when you're worried about you're going to make a mistake or something. It was like, it was a twisted, weird time for me. And it was very, very hard.
Do we do enough? I mean, were we doing enough then? And do we do enough now to sort of heal the healer? In other words, recognize that PTSD is an occupational hazard for people who have to make these critical decisions, lose people all the time. Are we paying enough attention to that?
I don't think so. I mean, there's a high suicide rate among clinicians, among nurses, doctors, dentists, etc., higher than the national average. There's a lot of lip service done. You know, so recently, a resident and a medical student took their lives at NYU last year. And, you know, NYU made a statement, you know, our hearts and sympathies go out to the family. But the key thing is to do something like the Mayo Clinic has done a really good job, and UCSD, University of California, San Diego, the medical school has, where they are very proactive about looking at leadership of each of their administrative units in the medical center there, doing questionnaires of the staff to find out, to identify people who are depression, offer them confidential counseling, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I would think that just making sure that everybody understands it's quite normal, that you're not sort of off, you know, you're not the weak member of our team if you exhibit this. This is what we expect of you to some extent, and we have things in place to help you.
Correct. And, you know, part of the problem is that, and especially in terms of our residents, that they're overworked, and there's no extra residents to step in to take over your duties if you need to take a leave or therapy. What are you going to say? Oh, I have to leave now in rounds because I have an appointment with my psychiatrist. That is very difficult for a resident to do, and it would require really enlightened leadership of a medical center to come up with a solution for that.
Once you retired, you started volunteering with Urban Ministries Open Door Clinic in Raleigh. Tell us more about that.
So it is a magical place. It's unfortunately we need something like that. North Carolina never expanded Medicaid, and if we did expand Medicaid, many people would be left out. But this is a place, it's one of the few places in the state where you can get actually full services at a sliding scale. So I have access to every medicine I need to treat my patients, every radiological test, chest x-rays, et cetera, and specialty care through donated by specialists in Wake County. And anybody's eligible as long as they live in Wake County and they don't have insurance and aren't eligible for insurance. And so I get to spend an hour with patients. Right. And when you have an hour with patients, you can actually work with them and they'll lose weight, they'll start taking their medicines, they'll stop smoking, they'll stop drugs. And two of my best successes are a young man and woman who had severe alcoholism, and they both had hepatitis C infection, and they're now both sober, working, paying taxes, and cured of their hepatitis C. And if you get an hour with a patient, you can do things.
So that means you can just yell at them for an hour more, telling them, you're ruining your life, stop drinking, what are you thinking?
Well, that's very funny because, my wife, who's also a physician, she talks about, motivating your patients and not yelling. And my actual go-to thing is to yell at my patients. What do you mean you're not taking your medicine? But actually, I've learned from her and other wonderful people that I listen to about how better to approach patients than yelling at them to take their medicines.
Which is what?
You listen to them. You take a history. Find out what will help them. So, if you have a patient who's got a severe mental illness and psychotic, then you find out are their family members, and you talk to the parents, and they'll help them take their medicines. With this young couple with alcoholism, I didn't make it a sine qua non that I would withhold the hepatitis C treatment until they stopped drinking. What I did is I started the hepatitis C treatment, but I put in the seed in their mind and said, I want you to think about stop drinking. It's not good to have both hepatitis C damaging your liver and the alcohol. Think about it, and I have got this medicine, that antabuse that I can give you that it will help you get off the alcohol, and think about it. And that's where I left it until they were cured, and 24 weeks later, all of a sudden, I got a text from each of them saying, hey, we want to start. What was the name of that drug you said we should take? And one of them I had to get into detox because he was so severely an alcoholic, and it just all worked out.
But you're saying, we have to put this in perspective now, because what you're saying is if we could spend more time with the patient, you would probably have better outcomes. And of course, all of the pressure in the medical profession for financial reasons is to spend less time, but you're saying, well, actually, if you want to spend less, you might want to spend more time up front.
Well, it's because we spend the money in the wrong things. So we do colonoscopies. We do, all the procedural specialties are paid at top dollar, getting your cataracts done and things like that. Whereas the thinking specialties, the primary care specialties, we don't pay enough. And the problem is that the great irony, of course, is that we're running out of primary care doctors. And so all these, the ophthalmologist, when he's on his deathbed and he wants a primary care person to take care of him, all that he's going to have is a dermatologist to apply an ointment or a cream. So, we need to pay our primary care docs for the time they spend with the patients.
Well, but this would turn our whole medical system upside down. I mean, right now we're paying three times what anybody else per capita for medical care than anybody else in the developed world does. We have worse outcomes. And you're saying, because we're doing everything completely backwards, or much of what we're doing backwards.
Yes.
And the tragedy is we've got these great research institutions that are turning out terrific medicine. And so we think about the science that we can bring and the advances that we can bring technologically. And then we've got a system that actually works in reverse. That seems to be a double whammy.
It's terrible.
So now you have this chance to spend an hour with patients. You're at Urban Ministries. And tell us about the Hep C. It's essentially an epidemic, right? It's really flared up.
There's 3 million people in the United States with Hep C and about 17,000 new people infected each year. It's become an epidemic because of the intravenous drug use epidemic. So we have the opioid epidemic, and those patients become infected. The good news is that we have this drug, one pill a day for 8 to 12 weeks. If you take it, you get cured, almost over 95%. Right.
So we just have to find people. And in a lot of cases, they might come to you by way of Urban Ministries because of the way in which they got the disease.
Well, it's recommended that everyone, all the baby boomers should be tested for hepatitis C. Anybody who's used intravenous drugs should be tested for hepatitis C. And it can be, although rarely, sexually transmitted as well. So if your partner has hepatitis C, you should be tested. And yes, then if you come to Urban Ministries, I'll cure you.
Well, let's talk about your political activism as well. We'll start with your opposition to the death penalty. That goes back a while, and you were taking on the then Democratic legislature, Democratic-controlled legislature.
So this was in 2006, and a good friend of mine, a retired physician, Arthur Finn, he called me up and said, "Will you write a letter saying doctors shouldn't be participating in executions?" And I actually wasn't against the death penalty then, and but I liked Art, and he said, "I'll do it." And so I wrote the letter, and then didn't hear anything. That was in April 2006, and then all of a sudden I got a call on July 3rd. Would I come testify? So I said, "Oh my goodness, I better find out what the death penalty is about." And I quickly read about it and realized it was a ridiculous mistake. There's clear evidence we've executed innocent people. That is a fact. It costs more to execute someone than it is to house them in a prison. If you are black, you're more likely to be executed than if you are white. So it was a bad thing. So I went and testified, and the board said no healthcare worker can participate in executions. And that was in 2006, and we haven't had an execution since then.
Your activism didn't end then. You were arrested. You got connected with the Reverend William Barber, of course, founder of the Moral Monday movement, and were arrested at one of those protests as well.
That's correct. I was arrested in 2013 and 2017 with Reverend Barber.
And talk about those policies that you, I mean, again, this is quite a commitment on your part. So what is it that you were resisting?
Well, the Republican-controlled state legislature has given me we're a two-physician, high-income family, a 50% tax cut, whereas they've slashed early childhood education. The public schools are not paying the teachers what they deserve. They haven't expanded Medicaid. We know there are 2,000 people dying each year for want of health insurance. And the irony, those are working North Carolinians. So they're paying taxes for my Medicare, yet they themselves are dying from their diabetes, their high blood pressure, their kidney disease, et cetera. So it's just an outrage. And so, one of the things, if you're a human being and a physician and you listen to your patients, you become an activist. I don't just want to take care of my patients' livers and lungs. I want to take care and make sure that they aren't treated well by society as a whole.
How do you think we've gotten to this point? I mean, you have people elected to office who find it very easy to take things away from poor people and give money to people who are already wealthy, as you just described. You described it very well. Taking things away from poor people and giving things to wealthy people, and they get elected. So that means it's not just them. What do you think is happening here? And I guess I would go back to your parents' experience in Europe in the first third of the 20th century and compare that to what's happening today in the United States.
We have this selfishness now. It's interesting. So all these people feel that they were, born on home plate, and they worked their way around the bases, and by their bootstraps. When in reality, just like our president Donald Trump, he was born on third plate and had to do nothing for it. You know, Art Pope thinks
it was tagged out four times.
Right. Yes.
And still made it home. Right.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Art Pope was born into a wealthy family. Mm. He didn't have to work hard or anything. So it's hard to be a poor person in North Carolina. It's a huge struggle. You can't. How are you going to pay for the gas to get to your job? Your car breaks down. You get a fine for, you know, you're for an expired license. And then how are you can't even afford that. And then you have to go to court and you lose your job because you're going to court. And it's an endless thing, a struggle. And so as a physician, it's absolutely an obligation. I have a position of power and I have to use it for good.
Well, you're doing that right now, working at the clinic, working on Hep C. Is there something else on the horizon for you? What's next?
Keep on doing. New challenges come up, I'll keep fighting for them.
All right, and we'll keep having you back. Charlie Vanderhorst, Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Charlie, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's great being here, Frank. Thanks a lot.
You can find out more about his work at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tomorrow on the State of Things, what happens when the speaker of a language is speaking a language that is dying? Language history, of course, carries our culture, and our history. And there's a lot of political power that goes with language. We'll talk about what it takes to save a dying language tomorrow on the State of Things. But that's it today. Thanks for listening. I'm Frank Stachow.